Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm speaking this week with Paul Gunter, an environmental activist and energy policy analyst who has opposed nuclear power for more than 30 years. In 1976, Paul co-founded Clamshell Alliance, an anti-nuclear group opposed to the construction of the Seabrook nuclear power plant in New Hampshire, 40 miles north of Boston. The Clamshell actions launched the anti-nuclear movement in the United States and helped shift public opinion so that nearly as many reactor projects were eventually cancelled as completed nationwide. In 1985, Paul led a New England-wide effort to halt the Department of Energy siting exploration in granite for the nation's high-level radioactive waste dump. 100 New Hampshire town meetings voted to oppose the burial, storage, transportation, and production of high-level nuclear waste in the Granite State. The DOE temporarily abandoned its search in granite sites in 1987 to focus on the fourth siting in Yucca Mountain, Nevada. Paul was director of the Reactor Watchdog Project at the Nuclear Information Resource Service for 16 years. He's now director of the Reactor Oversight Project at Beyond Nuclear, an organization committed to eliminating nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Paul is also a watchdog of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Paul, thanks for joining us on If You Love This Planet.
Well, thank you, Helen. This is really a pleasure.
Well, it's a pleasure for me. And, you know, we go back so long ago. I marched with you in, is it 1977 or 76?
April of 1976. We walked out on the Seabrook site before construction even began. You were our keynote speaker. And it was, for me, it was my first experience, really, in the issue of nuclear power. I had a gut experience to it, but it really sort of became the Sermon on the Mount, Helen, for me, in terms of what the risks and dangers of nuclear power really are. And it opened my eyes and committed us to a very long fight that goes on today.
Oh, yes, it never stops. I remember standing on the rubbish dump at where they built the reactor with a megaphone in hand, and it was a freezing cold early spring day in New England, and I had my daughter Penny with me, I think. So, yeah, it did start a lot, and you've continued nonstop ever since, Paul, and that's why it's a great pleasure and honor to have you on the program today.
Well, as you know, you're my inspiration on this, so let's hope that we can spread some of that inspiration and commitment to those listening out there.
That's right. Well, we have to inspire them, Paul. So what I want to talk about first, I think, is the nuclear industry says that nuclear power plants are emission-free, and that's why they're the absolute answer to global warming. We can talk about the CO2 or global warming gases that the whole nuclear fuel cycle emits, but I'd rather, I think, at this stage, concentrate on what they call routine emissions from operating nuclear power plants every second of every day into the air and water. Would you like to talk about that, Paul?
Certainly. From the very beginning, this whole notion that nuclear power is emissions-free is really a red herring, in that every minute of operation, the reactors are generating radiation, and in the form of high-level radioactive waste, low-level radioactive waste, and noble gases these noble gases, and particularly radioactive effluent, you know, liquid discharge, these are coming off the plant fairly routinely, either in the form of radioactive gases going out of the 300-foot stack. These are, sometimes they're deliberate ventings so that workers can go in and work inside containment. Some of them are operational emissions, but radioactive xenon, radioactive krypton, these gases are emitted, and they eventually, in their very short lives, they decay sometimes in the matter of seconds or to minutes to radioactive cesium, radioactive strontium, which are then particulate. And then, so the plants are actually, in the course of routine operation, emitting fallout that is carried downwind of the facility and then deposited, albeit these are, you know, routinely very minute doses, but they're very long-lived, and they can bioaccumulate, biomagnify in the pastures for cows, or in produce for human consumption, and then migrate up the food chain so that those of us along the way are exposed to minute but bioaccumulating doses of radioactivity. Also, there are these liquid discharges, largely radioactive hydrogen, tritium, which, frankly, are the releases are volumetrically so high that they have become cost prohibitive to regulate. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear industry, actually the nuclear industry all around the world and its champions, have allowed this radioactive effluent to be freely discharged under the guise that it's a so-called low-level radioactive waste. But the thing to know about tritium is that this radioactive form of hydrogen can go anywhere that water can go. It goes anywhere that the hydrogen atom can go. And so it can then, once it enters the body through either an inhalation or ingestion or absorption through skin, it can then travel to the most intimate levels of our biology, right down to the DNA structure. And there, its steady, short-ranged bombardment can damage cells, can damage DNA, and that's why it's a known clinical example for radioactive, radiogenic cancers, genetic mutations, or birth defects. This radioactive form of hydrogen can pass the placenta barrier from mother to fetus, and certainly one of the biggest concerns about these routine emissions is that the standards for radiation exposures are permitted by a reference dose to a middle-aged, healthy male who is the most robust of those who would be exposed to radiation, when in fact the radiation doses that we should be concerned with and really where the standard should be, it should focus on the most vulnerable among us. And so
that's children, immunocompromised people, and old people. Children
absolutely
are actually 10 to 20 times more radiosensitive or likely to get cancers after being exposed to radiation than that male that you talk about, standard male. And old people are pretty sensitive too. Paul, talk about what volume of water per day is used to cool a nuclear power plant and containing the tritium and other elements getting out of the reactor.
Typically, there are two discharge paths for these radioactive effluents. A nuclear power plant that's using a once-through cooling system, that is, they take water in directly to cool the steam coming off of the reactor through a condenser, and then they discharge it directly back into that same body of water, be it river, lake, reservoir, or ocean. And some of these large plants are taking in on the order of 1.5 billion gallons per day per unit. So if you've got a two-unit facility, that's about 3 billion gallons of water a day.
And that water that's discharged is mildly radioactive, correct?
Intake and discharge. And in that volume of water, there are radioactive elements.
Yeah.
But there's another discharge path, one that has been particularly focused on after tritium leaks were discovered at the Braidwood Nuclear Power Station in 2005.
Where is Braidwood?
It's one of the facilities in Illinois.
Yeah.
And it was discharging. It has a discharge pipe that discharges about 98,000 gallons per minute. And this pipe, a much smaller diameter pipe, leads directly into, in this case, the Kankakee River. This particular discharge is specifically for releasing radioactive effluent that's collected in a waste discharge tank. And it's through this discharge point that hundreds of curies can go out over any period of time, and in some cases even thousands of curies of radioactivity into these bodies of water. And in the Braidwood case, it came to light because there had been a series of mechanical failures of vacuum breaker valves along this discharge pipe that were there to make the flow very quick and smooth so that they could dump lots of radioactive water into the river very quickly and in a diluted form, you know. So the valves had been, this pipe had been used so much and not maintained that the vacuum breaker valves actually failed and became fountains. In two instances, these fountains gushed over 3 million gallons of water on each instant into cornfields that then flooded off-site into people's, across roads, ditches, into people's yards, over shallow drinking water wells, and the company never disclosed. This being Exelon Nuclear, the largest nuclear utility in the United States, they never disclosed these leaks. There were some 23 valve failures over a period of 10 years, but it was eventually disclosed through community efforts and through an industry whistleblower that the company had basically left this radioactive water to stand on site, absorb into the groundwater, and there is now a plume of radioactive tritium moving in groundwater around not only the Braidwood plant, but the subsequent discovery that just about every nuclear power plant in the United States has had these leaks, and they've been leaking into the groundwater for much better than a decade now.
And there are instances of, it seems, increased childhood malignancy around the Braidwood plant, including one or two brain tumors. It's hard to know if those malignancies were induced, in fact, by the leaks, but there seems to be circumstantial evidence that they possibly were, right?
Absolutely. There are, particularly around the Dresden Nuclear Power Station, another power plant operated by Exelon Nuclear that also had a series of similar leaks of underground pipes and tanks that released their radioactive tritium into groundwater. There are these clusters of concerned families where a very high incidence of pediatric brain tumors has been diagnosed, and enough so that some neighboring physicians are able to basically say, oh, you're from Grundy County, when the children come in to the clinic.
This is absolutely obscene, Paul, and I'm speaking now as a pediatrician. So what you're actually saying is that they've got a special pipe that drains from a special reservoir, radioactive water, on purpose into the body of water which is used to cool a reactor, but on the way the pipe may possibly leak and often does. But apart from the leakage, they're on purpose tipping large amounts of radioactivity from that reservoir into these bodies of water. I mean, it's like forcing a whole population of people to smoke, you know, and hooking
Absolutely.
Them up to smoking machines, and they eventually get lung cancer. But this is, you know, these isotopes, be it tritium or strontium or cesium or plutonium or americium or whatever is in the draining water, cause a variety of cancers in the body, right?
It certainly raises the risk. No, as we know, the clinical studies show there is no safe level of exposure to radiation. Every dose is added risk. And what is, again, what's I think worth emphasizing is the greatest risk is to children, to developing fetus, and the standards that are currently in place do not protect that population, our most vulnerable population.
I think people should know that the fetus is extremely vulnerable. And in fact, if you extrapolate to medical X-rays, one X-ray to the pregnant abdomen doubles the incidence of leukemia in that child when it's born. So we're talking about extremely vulnerable populations. And you're actually saying that every single reactor in the United States, of which there are 104 now, has found to be leaking, or almost every reactor, leaking radioactive elements into the surrounding soil and the water, right?
That's correct. The Indian Point Nuclear Power Station,
located
in Westchester County, New York, I think it's about 30 miles north of New York City, it was found to be leaking strontium-90 that was discovered in a test well. Again, these are discoveries subsequent to the Braidwood revelations, that the strontium-90 was three times the EPA acceptable level for groundwater, for drinking water. And the whole issue, though, is what's acceptable and what's permitted. This has to be reevaluated. This is should be one of the primary missions of concerned communities and environmentalists, is that we need to stop this deliberate exposure, which admittedly, by the NRC's own definition of as low as reasonably achievable, that's the standard that they release these radionuclides through, part of that reasonableness is an economic consideration. So again, the volumes of tritium that are coming out of these plants have been deemed uneconomical to regulate. I believe that in my take of that, that kind of deliberate exposure borders on criminal negligence.
When it's
done in secret and deliberately, that information, when these unplanned and unmonitored releases, which is a whole nother category in and of itself, when they're deliberately covered up, that I believe that then this, you know, should be bordering on a criminal investigation.
Oh, I totally agree. As a physician, people who are deliberately exposing people to carcinogenic materials, like the tobacco industry and the asbestos industry, deliberately, there needs to be a new law enacted, I believe, to indict these people and send them to jail.
Absolutely.
Having tried to, you know, cure children dying of leukemia and cystic fibrosis, or helping them to die. I mean, what's the value of one child's life?
Helen, I think you have an idea there. Every nuclear power plant in this country should have a big label suspended over it that says caution or warning. Operation of this facility may cause cancer.
It will cause cancer because we're talking about the radioactive waste as well as the routine emissions. And you know, people who are listening, I think we used to have a group in Australia called Bugger Up. We use bugger as a routine word in Australia. You probably don't there, but Bugger Up was a group of people, I think some of them were medical students, and they'd go out at night. No one could see them at 3 a.m. and paint signs on the posters and the advertisements for tobacco and the like, so that people would learn. I mean, I think we need to become more active now. Only those who feel like doing it, of course, but others can do it in ways that are more acceptable, possibly by using the talkback shows to educate people and the like. I want to get on now to what happens to the fish being sucked in. I mean, each reactor uses a million gallons a minute of water, and you've got a publication called License to Kill, How the Nuclear Industry Destroys Marine Habitat and Endangered Species to Save Money. Would you like just briefly, Paul, to summarize what that study shows?
We noticed, it must have been in the mid-90s. We had been monitoring various activities around nuclear power stations, and one that continually showed up was that during these tremendous intakes of water, remember, 3.5 billion gallons of water, that's about one square mile of water down to the depth of 14 feet being drawn into the power plant every day.
Good Lord.
And with that, it comes not only fish, but spawn, fingerlings, even endangered species like sturgeon and sea turtles were being documented, being taken into the nuclear power plants and either pasteurized and then spit back out.
What do you mean pasteurized?
Sediment.
Boiled?
Yes, but also turned into sediment. And then the larger animals, like the sea turtles, were being pinned against the intake grates of the facility and literally drown as they were trapped in that large intake. And what we noticed was that essentially the nuclear power industry was fishing without a license, that it was clearly one of the largest marine predators operating on coastal waters and on aquatic environments. And they were taking, not only were they taking in large volumes and destroying them, but when they spew out this water after it's gone through the condenser, it's sometimes 20 to 25 degrees hotter. So the discharge also creates these warmer environments where fish and all kinds of marine life will migrate into that warmer water, which is an artificial environment. And when the plant suddenly shuts down for either routine maintenance or refueling or a mishap, the water temperatures drop and the acclimated life in that body of water close to those discharge points, they go into thermal shock and they die. So there have been also reports of these very large fish kills around these discharge points at the nation's nuclear power stations. And I think one of the report primarily focuses on, though, is the relationship between this predatory industry, particularly with regard to requirements to comply with the Endangered Species Act, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is supposed to regulate and act as the go-between with the Endangered Species Act agency, the responsible agency being the National Marine Fisheries Service. And they would basically, our concern is that they've been manipulating biological assessments and biological opinions so that every time large kills of sea turtles or endangered species occurs, the industry and the federal agencies get together and they simply up the intake, the kill requirement, so that we've seen a steady rise through the 90s into the 21st century where the offending plant, you know, breaks a limit for intake kills. They're simply extended to larger kills.
They're allowed to kill more. I am now interviewing Paul Gunter, who's the director of the Reactor Oversight Project at Beyond Nuclear, an organization committed to eliminate nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And Paul is one of the leading experts on the dangers of nuclear power plants in the nation of the United States. Paul, I understand that you've recently been up to Canada, where, surprisingly enough, in Alberta, they have a lot of oil in the sands up there. They're called tar sands, and apparently they want to build new nuclear power plants to generate the electricity to separate the oil from the tar sands. And then, of course, when the oil is burnt, you create more carbon dioxide and more global warming. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Paul?
Absolutely. I think this is one of the biggest exposés on the nuclear industry's bogus claim at being a carbon-free industry. Aside from the carbon emissions from the fuel fabrication cycle, we now have an industry, not only in Canada, but this is also true for the nuclear industry's efforts to market in the Middle East, where nuclear power generation would offset oil consumption in those countries and increase imports of oil, such as from Saudi Arabia as well as Canada. The tar sands are potentially the second largest oil reserve in the world right now. The exploration is pointing to these, where oil has been concentrated in sand, and they're clear-cutting the boreal forests off the top of these areas and in northern Alberta, and they've been basically stripping the soil and extracting a product called bitumine, which is then the oil is extracted from that using incredible amounts of water and heat. And right now, the nuclear industry is looking to, well, they're projecting as many as 19 new reactor units for what is currently a nuclear-free Alberta, largely to power these oil extraction operations on the tar sands. So you have the worst of all worlds in that it would be a nuclear-fired carbon emission that would also basically raise the risk of not only carbon emissions, but radioactive wastes that are generated in the process.
Yes.
So it's really double dirty.
Right.
But more importantly, it's an expose that the coal, oil, and nuclear industry have long been in cahoots as a hegemony that has never been about displacing one for the other, but simply getting more of each, so that it would be, you know, the secret meetings with Vice President Cheney and the energy industry here in the United States was coal, oil, and nuclear making their plans on how they could make their grab even bigger. If you take coal, oil, and nuclear and you put that into the context of an acronym, that's CON, and that's exactly what's happening right now, is a con job, a confidence game that's being played to basically increase the riches of a very few at the expense of a global climate disaster.
Right. Well, you know, the three major catastrophes facing the human race now and all other species on the planet is the ever-present threat of nuclear war, the carcinogenic risk long-term and genetic engineering of nuclear power, and global warming. So, in fact, those three industries include those three risks, and we've got a lot of work to do to shut them down. I'm interviewing Paul Gunter now from the Beyond Nuclear Project, which is an organization committed to eliminating nuclear power and nuclear weapons, and I want you all to listen very carefully to what he's saying. I'm Helen Caldicott, and this program is called If You Love This Planet. Paul, you mentioned nuclear waste. I'd like you just briefly to summarize how much there is, how dangerous it is, and what on earth they're going to do about it in the United States.
Let me just start by saying that electricity is but a fleeting product of nuclear power generation. The enduring product is nuclear waste. It comes in the form of the high-level radioactive waste, which is essentially the irradiated fuel, that the fuel rods that are discharged on average of every 2 years from nuclear power plants and stored in pools and in casks on site.
And what elements do these irradiated, uranium irradiated rods now contain after they've been in the reactor? What new elements are in the rods?
The whole radioactive chart. Some of the principal ones are plutonium, radioactive cesium, radioactive strontium, cobalt, nickel. It goes on and on and on. And many of these are extremely long-lived. The irradiation that's coming off of these extremely thermally hot fuel assemblies can deliver deadly doses within seconds. And because it's thermally hot, it has to be continuously cooled long after it is discharged from the reactors. So along with the irradiated fuel, however, everything that this material comes in contact with through the radioactive water, through the bombardment of the radiation fields coming off of the fuel, these also become radioactive from the steel and the copper and the concrete. It all becomes what the industry and regulator have commonly referenced as low-level radiation, but it's anything from low-level. It also can contain highly poisonous plutonium, for example. And then this has been, traditionally, it's been shipped off to places like Barnwell, South Carolina. But this summer, Barnwell, South Carolina, is closing its gates to radioactive waste other than from Connecticut, New Jersey, and South Carolina. So all the other states are basically now, their nuclear waste is homeless, except where it's being generated. So the nuclear facilities around the United States, by and large, are now de facto high-level radioactive waste and low-level radioactive waste dumps.
How much, what's the volume now of, or weight of the collected high-level radioactive waste fuel rods in America?
I believe that we stand right now at about 60,000 metric tons.
60,000 metric tons.
Of high-level radioactive waste.
And what are the plans for removal of this waste from the cooling pools at all the 104 reactor sites in the country?
Originally, the plan was for two repositories around the United States, one out west and one out east. This was in the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. But in 1987, again, after stunning public demonstrations primarily out east, the industry and Congress, the champions of the nuclear industry, got together, and in the Nuclear Waste Policy Amendments Act of 1987, essentially focused all of the nation's nuclear waste to be dumped in Yucca Mountain, Nevada. This, of course, if you thought that this was a scientific process, obviously this makes it very clear that this is really more akin to a political mugging. If it were a scientific process, we'd be looking at three geological facilities, for example, and to pick the best of the worst. But in fact, the only site that the U.S. Congress and Department of Energy and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear industry are looking at right now is Yucca Mountain, Nevada, which is 90 miles from Las Vegas and, the largest, fastest-growing metropolitan area in the United States. And it is a site that is known for its frequent earthquakes and surrounded by very young volcanoes. The Lathrop Well cinder cones are visible from where they're proposing to put 70,000 metric tons virtually forever underground. And this is a large desert mesa that is saturated with water. There's an aquifer that moves under it for the Colorado River. The notion that forced location anywhere, I think, basically puts the very bright light on how undemocratic nuclear power really is. This kind of political pressure is necessary to force nuclear waste onto one state after another. This is simply again undemocratic. But the fact is that the fight is fierce in Nevada. The site is not environmentally sound. This is not technically justifiable issue. As a matter of fact, right now it's been identified that Yucca Mountain cannot take credit for waste isolation. So even in the forced location that they're proposing to license this facility, all of the credit for containing the radiation is basically in the design of the dry casks or the containers that will hold the waste.
Yeah.
Well, if that's the case, you might as well line these casks, all 70,000 metric tons of it, and put it out onto the nation's mall, right there under the nose of Congress, to show and demonstrate how totally irresponsible this industry has been over the past 50 years, operating without any kind of scientifically approved or democratic process for managing its high-level radioactive waste.
So, Paul, you're a man who really knows what's going on, and you've got two little girls. What are they, aged 7?
Both are 7 years old.
Yeah. So, and you're passionate about this. If given your druthers, Paul, what would you do about the nuclear industry right now? Say you were the president. What would you do?
Begin the prompt phase-out of nuclear power. It would be as quickly as you would recognize trying to get out of a house on fire.
What would you do with the nuclear waste?
I think that we would have to first make it safe and secure, more importantly, secure. It would have to be on sites where it was the points of generation are, in fact, the points where this stuff must stay, you know, for now, since we don't know what to do with it. Every time you move it, you risk breaking up the fuel assemblies and, you know, making more of a radiological crisis as these assemblies break up. But at the same time, you not only have to safeguard against the intense radioactivity from these fuel rods, but we have to secure them. And this is what makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck every time I talk about this. We have 35 reactors, Helen, in this country, six of them around Chicago, that store all of their high-level irradiated fuel in pools that are 6 to 10 stories up in the reactor building outside of containment, literally in pools on top of the reactor roof. And it's our concern that, and as well as the concern of the National Academy of Sciences, I might add, that these pools are extremely vulnerable right now, today, to aircraft, for example, where my main concern and the concern that we have sought to initiate everything from investigations by Congress, the Department of Justice, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and we hammer the Nuclear Regulatory Commission regularly, is that it doesn't take a commercial aircraft to open one of these vulnerable General Electric boiling water reactors, to open it up and to create a nuclear fuel fire that would make Chernobyl look like 4th of July fireworks display.
What about terrorism?
That's precisely the concern, is that private aircraft loaded with explosives, you know, where there are no reinforced cockpit doors, there are no pilot screenings, passenger screenings, no cargo screening, no sky marshal. They could come from a private airfield, and they would come without warning, and they could come in more than just a single aircraft.
And destroy Chicago, for instance, which is surrounded by 13 nuclear power plants.
Absolutely.
It's really,
yet we cannot get the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to recognize these dirty bombs in our backyard.
Yeah, dirty bombs in the backyard. That really is a title for a new book, isn't it, Paul? I as a physician, I'm almost speechless about the nuclear industry. And apart from a meltdown and a dirty bomb in the backyard and routine emissions, the radioactive waste, which lasts for up to 500,000 years, will inevitably start leaking within 100 years, get into water supplies, magnify in food chains, and induce epidemics of malignancy for the rest of time, and I guess random compulsory genetic engineering forevermore. So this industry, from a medical perspective, must be closed down on an urgency basis. There are lots of other ways to generate electricity if we want to talk about that. But if we want to talk about health impacts, I can hardly think of a more urgent thing to do apart from, you know, eliminating nuclear weapons on the agenda of the United States Congress. And yet most Congress people seem to be fairly sound asleep about this issue, don't they, Paul?
Well, of growing concern is the fact that the industry is now poised for what it calls a renaissance, what we clearly view as a relapse, where right now there are about 30 new units being proposed for construction here in the United States. And, you know, these new designs, while they claim to be inherently safe, are essentially no better than the others. The same old problems.
Are
occurring.
Do you think that, I'm sorry I'm interrupting you, but do you think that the only thing that will actually stop the nuclear industry dead in its tracks is another meltdown, Paul?
Helen, at that point, it's really, you know, it's really irrelevant. The scope of the Chernobyl disaster, if that were to happen here in the United States, I think that it would also foster economic collapse as well as environmental collapse. And let's also remember that the Chernobyl accident was from a reactor that was only 2 years old. Mm. We're looking at reactors here in the United States that are 30, 38 years old, like the Oyster Creek Nuclear Power Station in Toms River, New Jersey, which is just 60 miles southwest of New York City. Mm. This is one of these General Electric boiling water reactors. Basically, one of the things that I discovered in researching this reactor when they were talking about extending the operating license of Oyster Creek, for which is the oldest nuclear power station in the United States, mm. extending that license for another 20 years,
yeah.
We discovered that the containment building was corroded.
Mm.
Where down a 100-foot structure, very extremely heavy steel structure, at the base, right around the 11th-foot level, the wall of the containment had corroded through fully half the thickness of the wall.
So what do you think would happen politically in the United States if Oyster Creek melted down?
I'm afraid to think, because
you have to think, though, Paul.
You have to look at the scope of this. It would, you know, our current emergency plans only look out to 10-mile radiuses for evacuation and 50 yeah. miles for, you know, ingestion planning.
Well, we'd have to say that tens of thousands of people would die, some acutely dying within the first 2 weeks, and others getting leukemias and cancers 5 to 15
yes.
years later.
And it would be up and down the eastern seaboard,
yeah.
not just within this very politically defined area that, you know, our current emergency plans are patterned around. But, you know, these, again, it would make the level of incompetence and callousness for the Katrina disaster, it would just eclipse that
yeah.
by the sheer fact that we know that the radionuclides in that plant are deadly, and that their consequence goes well beyond the current planning zone. So the levees all around the this particular disaster are known to be fragile
right.
and way too low.
Well, I'm afraid the truth is, and I now speak as a physician, that we must imagine the consequences, because it's absolutely not out of the question that we, the United States and indeed the world, might soon have to cope with such an extraordinary catastrophe of a meltdown of a reactor, maybe on the East Coast where the population is so dense. Look, we've reached the end of our time now, Paul, and I really want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for the amount of dedication of years and years that you've given to this fight, and that you, amongst a few others, will be some of our unsung heroes, and that we do all now have the opportunity to close down the nuclear industry. Indeed, we must, from a medical perspective. And do you have a site where people can go, Paul, to obtain more information?
Yes, people can reach our website through beyondnuclear.org. We're happy to take questions and comments, and we're available for further resource, and we look forward to working with you towards an optimistic, energy-efficient, renewable energy 21st century.
And if anyone wants to donate money to Beyond Nuclear, that would be a wonderful investment for you to make for the future, for your children and the planet. Paul, I want to thank you so much for appearing today on If You Love This Planet, and I look forward to speaking to you in the future.
Thank you so much, Helen.
That was Paul Gunter, Director of the Reactor Oversight Project at Beyond Nuclear. You can view their website at beyondnuclear.org.
What you're about to hear is an excerpt from the 1983 Oscar-winning documentary If You Love This Planet. This production of the National Film Board of Canada features Australian pediatrician Helen Caldicott delivering a lecture on the potential medical and societal consequences of a nuclear war. The film includes newsreel records of the beginnings of the arms race and the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This film was labeled foreign political propaganda by the United States Justice Department in an attempt to limit its distribution. All distributors who sold a copy were required to give the purchaser's name to the Justice Department. This may have had the opposite effect from the suppression desired by the Reagan administration, as the negative label caused a rallying of support around the film from anti-censorship activists. During her Oscar acceptance speech, director Terry Nash thanked the U.S. Justice Department for their effective advertisement of her film.
Now, once the button's pressed, the weapons and their missiles go out into space. The space race has been mainly about weapons. They re-enter the Earth's atmosphere at 20 times the speed of sound and then land accurately on target. Meanwhile, the satellite and the radar from the other side detects the attack and the button's pressed. So the weapons pass virtually in space and the whole thing's over within about half an hour. So you can't really talk about an aggressor in half an hour, can you? Or it's your fault. I mean, you don't even have time to think. I mean, all you can have time to do is press the button. A 20-megaton bomb would do this. I'm now quoting from the New England Journal of Medicine in 1962. It would gouge out a crater half a mile wide and 300 feet deep so that everything in that volume would be converted to radioactive fallout, be pulverized, millions of tons of rock injected into the stratosphere and troposphere where it would descend as radioactive fallout. Every person out to a radius of 6 miles from the epicenter would be vaporized, just turn into gas, and most buildings. Out to a radius of 20 miles from the center, most persons would be dead or lethally injured. And when I say lethally injured, I mean tens of thousands of cases of the most severe burns. A single burn takes about 3 to 6 months to treat, requiring hundreds of units of fresh frozen plasma and blood, 24-hour intensive care nursing, operations every couple of days for months, and then often the patients die. There are only 2,000 acute burn beds in the whole of the United States. There would be shocking injuries, you see, as people are sucked out of buildings and thrown against other buildings. Buildings disintegrate and concrete and steel are thrown around like matchsticks. Millions of shards of flying glass as windows disintegrate. People decapitated, organ injuries, ruptured lungs, compound fractures. That compound fracture means the bones sticking out of the skin, and so on. What was left of the buildings would be lying in what was left of the streets. If you looked at the blast or the flash from 40 miles away, just glanced at it, you'd be instantly blinded as the flash burnt the retina or the back of the eye. It would ignite everything that was inflammable within an area of 3,000 square miles. So everything would burn and the fires would coalesce, sucking the air in with hurricane force winds to the center of the explosion. And if you made it to a fallout shelter in that 20 minutes to half an hour's time, you would not survive because you would be pressure cooked and or asphyxiated as the fires used up all the oxygen. In the Dresden firestorms, the people who made it to the shelters all died. They asphyxiated. Now, you should know that your Civil Defense Department says that every town and city in this country with a population of 25,000 people or more is so targeted. Not necessarily with a 20-megaton bomb, it may be smaller, but all these bombs do an enormous amount of damage, which means, in effect, that most population centers in this country will be gone. Also, apparently, the nuclear reactors are targeted. Inside each 1,000-megawatt nuclear reactor is as much radiation as that released by the explosion of 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. If you should drop a 1-megaton bomb on such a reactor, according to the Scientific American last month, you would contaminate permanently an area the size of West Germany, and that would obviously aggravate the fallout problem. The oil refineries are targeted, the large industries, and all airports. Now, say you weren't in a targeted area, and you were in a rural area that was untargeted, and you're not asleep, all right? You're not asleep, and you are actually listening to the radio or watching the television. Now, you often hear the radio, you hear this, ooh, we were just testing the emergency signal, don't you? You hear that? Well, this time, I suppose they'd say, we're not testing, this is for real, the bombs are on their way, you have 15 minutes, 20 minutes, or whatever, to reach the nearest fallout shelter. So you run very fast, I mean very fast. And you won't have time to collect your family with you or anyone you love, almost certainly, unless you're very lucky. Now, this is also described in the New England Journal of Medicine. When you get down there, you medically will not be able to re-emerge from that shelter for at least 2 weeks to 6 to 8 weeks, because the short-lived radioactive isotopes in the fallout are so intensely radioactive, you would die. And when you do come out, the world would be a different place, because civilization's past that we've inherited from our ancestors will be totally obliterated. All the architecture, the music, imagine the world without Handel and Beethoven and Brahms. The art, the literature, everything will be gone. And you see, in Hiroshima, there was an outside world to come and help. There'll be nobody. And further, there will be millions of corpses. A 20 megaton bomb on Boston in 1962 was estimated to have created 2.2 million corpses. And as the bodies rot and decay, the bacteria, which is a perfect breeding place for bacteria, multiply rapidly. And they mutate in the radioactive environment to become more lethal and virulent. And our white blood cells, which fight infection and protect us from infection, are depleted by the effects of radiation. So we will be susceptible to all the diseases we now medically control, like polio, typhoid, plague, dysentery, hundreds of them. So there'll be epidemics of diseases. It is thought that so much ozone will be destroyed by the release of nitrous oxides created by the explosions that the ultraviolet radiation coming in from the sun will produce third-degree sunburn within 15 to 30 minutes, which is lethal. And it would blind people. In other words, you would have to live underground for the next 5 to 10 years or however long it takes for the ozone to reaccumulate. Of course, it will burn and parch all the crops. There'll be very few hospitals left, if any. Very few doctors left. And we hold symposia on this subject, on the medical consequences of nuclear war. They are addressed by Howard Hyatt, the Dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, and others. And we estimate that within about 30 days after such an exchange, 90% of Americans would be dead. Canadians as well, the Russians as well, the Europeans, the British are all targeted like that, most of the Chinese. It is really unknown what will happen to the whole world. But consider this data. The National Academy of Sciences in 1975 estimated if both superpowers used only 10% of the arsenals of their hydrogen bombs, 10%, it could destroy 50 to 80% of the ozone layer in the northern hemisphere and 30 to 40% in the southern hemisphere. And some scientists think if only 20% of it is destroyed worldwide, it could blind every organism on the Earth. And people would die, the survivors would die of a synergistic combination of starvation, radiation sickness, epidemics of infection, sunburn, blindness, and grief. It would be the grief that would kill me. I would prefer to be dead, and it was Nikita Khrushchev who said, in fact, in the event of a nuclear war, the living will envy the dead. Now you can say, well, what can I do? There are two things I'm doing just to give you some ideas. You've got to work it out yourself. The Physicians for Social Responsibility was dormant 2 years ago. We're now educating our colleagues. We have 4,500 doctors, and the American Medical Association recently wrote to President Reagan because of our activities, asking him to meet with senior members of the American medical profession to discuss nuclear war. And remember that all the politicians are our patients, even the president. Now, I don't know if the people that treated him are members of Physicians for Social Responsibility, but they will be soon. The other thing I did was start the Women's Party for Survival, because as I talk a lot about this, very often it's the women who cry. Now, I'm not excluding all mothering men, but you know, women are very passionate. In fact, they often drive men crazy because they're so passionate and emotional. That's appropriate to be emotional. Often when I lay out the medical effects of nuclear war, the person interviewing me on television will say, aren't you being a bit emotional? You can understand that that's a crazy remark to make. It's like if I have two parents in my office and I tell them their child has leukemia and explain the prognosis and they show no emotional response, I get them a psychiatrist. It's appropriate to be passionate about our survival. And I thought, when I had my first baby, I knew I'd die to save that life. And I'd never felt like that about any other human life before. It was a profound revelation for me. If we can mobilize that instinct that women have to save their babies across the world, we may survive. So I started the Women's Party for Survival, and we're having a march on Mother's Day in Washington, wearing our Sunday best, Republican ladies, everybody, because this is a very conservative issue, the ultimate conservative issue. And bring lots of babies, and if you haven't got a baby, borrow one. And the next day on Monday, we're going to lobby our representatives on the Hill and put the baby on the table and say, Senator Jackson or Senator Helms, why aren't you representing the life of this baby? And the baby is our symbol. Now, to give you another crazy idea, there are lots of things you can do, you see. We thought of an action called Babies Against the Pentagon, and that abbreviates to BAP. What we do is, when the Senate is debating the arms race, we will release hundreds of naked toddlers into the Senate chamber. Lots of things you can do. You're next to the SAC air base here. Close it down. Don't take no for an answer. Don't take no for an answer. It must be done. It must be done. These weapons must be eradicated from the face of the planet bilaterally, multilaterally. Then people will say, what about the Russians? You can't trust the Russians. Remember that right through Vietnam and Cambodia, Russia and America negotiated SALT I. Quite a good treaty. The superpowers have signed 17 treaties on nuclear weapons. Neither side have ever violated them. Russia's signed SALT II. America hasn't. Why not? Why not? Because, say the senators, America wants to maintain its superiority. What does that mean? We're on a terminally ill planet, you know that. And we are about to destroy ourselves. And when a patient comes into the emergency room who's terminally ill, we don't say, well, that patient's terminally ill, take them straight to the mortuary. We put the patient in the intensive care unit and we delicately balance the electrolytes and we stabilize the cardiac function and we eradicate the infecting organism. And occasionally, the patient survives. And what I'm really saying to you is that if you love this planet, and I'm deeply in love with it, and you watch the spring come, and you watch the magnolias flower, and the wisteria come out, and you smell a rose, you will realize that you are going to have to change the priorities of your life if you love this planet.
This is an excerpt from the 1983 Oscar-winning documentary, If You Love This Planet.
That's the show for today. Next week, my guest is Dr. Alan Robock, Professor of Climatology in the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University and the Associate Director of its Center for Environmental Prediction. Thanks for listening to If You Love This Planet. I'm Helen Caldicott, and I'll look forward to your company next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is recorded at 2XX FM Community Radio in Canberra, Australia, and produced by Scott Powell, Amanda Bellerby, and Jasmine Williams. For more information on this program, to listen to previous shows, or to make a donation, visit our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org.